All right, welcome. Welcome to this week's W3C CCG meeting. So today we're going to talk about a very interesting topic. We got Dimitri here to actually talk about verifiable governance. Governance, in my opinion, is one of the things that we don't talk about enough. We oftentimes talk about the technologies, digital signatures and things like that, but I think to have a real robust trust framework, you actually do need a human element. You do need a good governance. So I haven't previewed what Dimitri is going to talk about, but I'm actually quite excited about what we're going to discuss today. So, but before we get there, I just want to do a quick code of ethics and professional conduct reminder. Just want to make sure that if you agree or disagree, doesn't matter about whether you have agree or disagree with other people's opinion. Just remember to be respectful to each other. A quick intellectual property note, anyone can participate in these calls. However, all substantive contributions to any CCG work items must be members of the CCG with full IPR agreement signed. So, if you have any questions about that or you have troubles creating a W3C account, please just reach out to any of the co-chairs, whether it's myself or Kimberly. These meetings are being automatically recorded and transcribed. So we publish these meeting notes usually a day or within the next following days. So if you encounter some issues, like for example, last week, we had some technical issues, please just let us know and we'll try to, do the best, as best as we can. Next we use a GC chat to queue speakers. So you can type in Q+ to add yourself to the queue or Q- to remove. You can type in Q? To see who is in the queue. All right, it's time for introductions and reintroductions. So if you are new to the community, relatively new to the community, or you haven't been active and want to re-engage with the community, please feel free to just unmute and speak. All right, so we do this every week. So if you're feeling a little bit shy right now, you can always just unmute next week. This is a very, very open and inclusive community. So feel free to just unmute and say things. All right, next, announcements and reminders. Any announcements or reminders? So first of all, Kimberly has sent out an email in regards to the nominations for the co-chair. So there's instructions in regards to how to do that. First of all, you have to self-nominate and then other people can actually weigh in and things like that. Actually, Kimberly, since you're on, like, you might actually just explain it a little bit. I think you can do a better job than me explaining how this process works.
Sure, I'm happy to. Yes. But you had it right. You need to self-nominate by sending an email to the group. Nominations will be open until, next Tuesday. And then, from there, we'll have a 2-week period for, candidates to, share a little bit more about themselves. We'll probably have a discussion and then, voting will begin. I don't have the email in front of me, but I think it's whatever that Tuesday is that's 3 weeks from today. So yes, thank you.
Thanks a lot. So Kimberly and I have discussed this quite a bit. We hope to find a technical culture to help us out, and especially in shepherding and guiding, some of the work items that we got. Just want to give a quick shout out to Will for actually the nominations. I think he's one of those technical cultures, right, candidates that we have huge respect for, and as well as want to thank him for actually raising his hand. But if you know someone or wants to, you know, nominate yourself, please feel free to do so. Okay. Any other announcements or reminders? All right, a quick preview of what's coming. So next week we'll have Sharon to give an update on jobs for the future. And then the week after that, on December 12th, we will have Andrew to talk about mobile driver license, what's new. And then we'll have 2 weeks hiatus for the holidays because, you know, Christmas and New Year's are coming. So we'll have a 2 week hiatus and we'll resume on January 2nd, where Dimitri will come back and actually talk about credentials rendering. All right. Before we get to the main agenda, any other announcements or reminders or updates on the work items? All right, so let's get to the main agenda. So today, we're very excited to have Dimitri here to actually talk about verifiable governance. As I actually shared in the beginning, this is a topic that I'm quite excited about because oftentimes we talk about the technology, the digital signature, selected disclosure mechanisms, which we have been, which we have been discussing in the last few months. But, you know, one of the most important things about building trust, and by the way, there's different definitions of trust, but my favorite one is based on game theory, which is about having that mutual cooperation toward a common goal, right? So I think having that human factor is quite important, and that's why governance is actually a key aspect of that trust framework. And very excited to have this conversation. So Dimitri, the floor is yours.
Thank you. So I'm really excited to be here. I'm Dimitri Zagadulin, software engineer in the credentials and decentralized identity space. And I would love to be able to say that we've solved the problem of having bulletproof, equitable governance. Sadly, we have not, though give it time, right? Super intelligent AIs are on the horizon. I'm sure they'll sort it out for us. But meanwhile, what we want to talk about is the data model. Once you pick a system of governance, how do you capture it? How do you log it? And how do you lock down everything with all the signatures? Right? So large part of what we're interested in the verifiable credential and decentralized identifier space. That's exactly why we came up with these tools so that we can get onto more complex layers like governance. All right, so real quick, what do we mean by governance? Going to the dictionary, it's a process of making decisions in a group, right? Pretty much anything we can think about, whether it's a governance of a blockchain or a city's city council all the way up to the federal level, it all boils down to making decisions and recording those decisions. And that's what we mean by verifiable. Capturing the entire context, everything relevant at the time. Who made the, what the decision was, who made it, at what time, and were their keys valid, right? That's, we care a lot about that, everything. So if you take nothing else from this presentation, it's, what's governance? Logs of decisions. Sign everything. That's it. But let's get into the details. And by the way, at any point, feel free to jump on the queue to ask questions. All right, so what do we need to model governance? Well, we should have a data model of actually making the decisions. And as you can probably imagine, this can be arbitrarily complex. So we're starting with a very simple model for it, right? So we've got data model for decisions, data model for actors making those decisions, which essentially for us is DIDS, either for single actors like individuals or for groups of people like corporations, nonprofits, and so on. And specifically, we want to pay the item three. We want to pay attention to when somebody is signing off on a decision, which corporation or which group did they belong to? Were they authorized by the group? Were they an officer or some other member of the group? Right. So we're going to be talking about signatures. So specifically this work, what are we bringing here, right? We've got the components that we all know and love, DIDs and verifiable credentials. Well, we're proposing a simple data model for recording the decisions. We're highlighting the use of self-authenticated identifiers, so hash links. And in addition, we're talking about, all right, so how do we use DIDs to model group and group membership? And similarly, how do we use verifiable credentials to assign roles in group membership? Right? So pretty simple. Real quick, Bengo, do you mind muting?
Nope. Thank you.
No problem. All right. So definitions, individual, role, group, organization, we're using them fairly intuitively. Okay, so what's a governance decision? Governance decision is where we're modeling it as subject of the decision, which means the decision itself, the review request, which is essentially the discussion of the decision, and then the review result. Those of you attending a lot of standards calls may be familiar with it from proposals, right? So we have an issue, like, should we add this thing to the spec? We have a review request, which is proposal. People vote on it, and then you record the result. Everybody, we have this many pluses, this many minuses. That's one example of a governance decision. So first, let's talk about self-authenticating identifiers, because we're essentially, in order to accurately capture the context of a verifiable governance decision, we're going to need to lock everything down cryptographically. And what do we mean by that? We want stable identifiers, and we want to digest hash everything to make sure that, look, at the time that we made this decision, this was the phrasing of the thing we were discussing. So what do we got for stable identifiers? We've got DIDs, of course, which we're familiar with. The reason I say overkill here is we could give DIDs to literally everything, like any meeting notes, any question posed before the group, anything. But it's not quite the right fit, because a decision doesn't need its own keys, or a, you know, paragraph 2 on the meeting agenda doesn't need its own keys. It by itself is not an actor. We've got, of course, random UUID URNs. That's a pretty good globally unique identifier. But by itself, it doesn't give us the integrity protection, right? We can't lock down the contents of what we're talking about. And then, of course, we have SIDs, which is just stands for Content Addressable Identifiers. The term SID, popularized by IPFS, though we are increasingly starting to use these in the verifiable credential world to either link credentials together or link from a credential to external binaries like images and PDFs. And it's great because SIDs give us content integrity, are deterministic to calculate and verify. And so basically you can think about it anywhere you put a URL. If the thing you're linking to, it doesn't change that often, you should use a SID. You should use a hash link there. Now, Juan points out something interesting in the chat, which I'll get to in just a second. Often, or some types of content identifiers are location independent, and some are not. Whether or not the location independence is important to your use case depends on the use case. In some cases, it makes sense to combine the location and the content address. In others, to divorce the two. But here's what I mean about anytime you're using a URL, consider using a hash link. But only if you're linking to a stable object, like a final version of a document, a blob of JSON, a PDF, an image, a movie that you've finished editing, etc. Because when does it not make sense to use hash links? Well, for example, linking to the front page of the New York Times, right? Because the moment you link to it, the very moment, it's that hash is not going to be valid because news feeds, Twitter feeds, even timestamps, right? Those websites that be like, all right, the current time is this and this, break the hash link. So hash links are for stable resources. All right, so what are some examples of SIDs? Location dependent or not. So the general pattern is it's a URL and it includes in itself a digest hash. So here's the this first example is the content identifier version 1 widely used by IPFS. They also have a version 0 which follows very similar syntax. We have this concept of a digest SRI in the verifiable credential 2.0 data model. So if you look at section 5.4 of the latest VC data model spec, there's a mechanism to refer to things and provide their digest hash, right? So first part of a digest hash is the algorithm that you're using to hash. And then the second part is a text-encoded hash itself. In the case of digest SRI, it's always base64 URL encoded. That's not the point. But this overall pattern of, say, the algorithm and then the actual encoded hash is pretty much what's used by all SIDs and hash links, right? We also have the ITF individual draft multi-hash, draft 7, which essentially uses the exact same notation as IPFS SIDs. And then, of course, we have an older RFC from 2013 on naming things with hashes. As you can see, it's the same sort of pattern. It has its own protocol type, NI, which incidentally stands for named information. But then it specifies the hashing algorithm and then a text-encoded hash itself. So any questions about this concept? Okay. As Juan points out, that the particular example that I gave doesn't have a location, just the hash. The RFC does have a way to also add a location or multiple locations, but we didn't want to add it here. So, excellent point. Okay. So for any given decision, we're going to be using lots of content identifiers for things and DIDs for actors, for people or corporations, essentially, or other groups. Let's talk about, so what is a review request? Let's think of it in terms of a GitHub pull request or a merge request. That is, though, a technical and obscure example on the one hand, but on the other hand, it incorporates in itself pretty much any governance decision, any question that you're likely to hear at a city council meeting. We've got the subject. So let's think about a PR. In our terminology, the subject is going to be the changed files the code patch itself, right? That's the subject. Git actually already uses self-authenticating identifiers because Git straight up uses commit hashes. Like it literally takes the proposed changes, hashes them, and uses that as a stable identifier for any patch, including the patch in the pull request. Now, what's a review request? Well, it's an implicit or explicit set of rules that any given team or organization uses to accept the pull request. For example, if you're a single developer working on your own project, your set of acceptance is look it over briefly, accept. Right? Very minimal, but that is the criteria. Oh, it's by me? Well, I'm going to accept it. If you're more on the ball, you at least wait for the CI, for the automated tests and syntax checkers to complete, and then you accept it, right? But that's the acceptance criteria. And as Juan points out in chat, a lot of times the cultural steps, the non-machine enforceable steps, are spelled out in the contributing document. This is usually where you say, okay, we only accept pull requests. Our review request criteria is you have to open an issue first, and the automated tests have to pass green, and it needs to be reviewed by two of the project maintainers. And that's what the result is, the review result. It's a set of verifiable credentials, right? Because all you have is a hammer. It's verifiable credentials signed by decentralized identifiers, approving each rule, each criterion of a review request. So in our GitHub sense, in our GitHub example, subject, the changed, proposed change itself. The review request is whatever cultural norms the project requires, such as we need two signatures from two of our members, right? That's a fairly common dev team criteria. And the result, actual upvotes plus ones, any comments or other kind of sign-offs by project maintainers. And then, of course, how do you know they're part of the project? Well, GitHub has its own method of checking group membership. We're going to be talking about a generic data model for specifying that. So just to clarify, any governance decision, we're essentially modeling it or simplifying it to what's the decision about? What are the steps? What are the steps that need to be performed for the decision to be considered legitimate? Right? So that's essentially the governance system there in a nutshell. And then the result of the decision is for each criteria, the required number of people sign off. And then, if appropriate, the overall request outcome. So if it's a two-part legislature bill, there would be a verifiable credential on a sign-off for each part. And then an overall, did the bill pass, would be signed by the group or the governing body itself. So here we're talking in the abstract. As a developer, I often find it really useful to look at screenshots, right? For pretty much anything, give me screenshots, give me code examples, and I'd be able to, yeah, okay, I see what we're doing here. So this is not the canonical implementation of this. This is one implementation. This is one interpretation of this data model used here solely for illustrative purposes, right? So for example, this kind of goes back to our GitHub PR. We're talking about a governance decision. What's the decision about? Oh, it's a decision about these files. And we're identifying them by a content address identifier. Literally, we took a directory listing of them, concatenated the bytes of all the files, took a hash of it, and there's our stable identifier. Denoting for all time that when we were deciding, this is the thing we were deciding about. Integrity protected, can't be changed, etc. Here's a sample. So for that set of files, here's a sample review plan, a set of criteria. So what do we mean? This in particular one is criteria applied to machine learning, right? For those of us following in the artificial intelligence, large language model, and machine learning news, one of the things that often comes up is notions of attribution and notions of governance and equity. Where did the training data set come from? Did its authors contributing to the data set agree? Can we track them? Can we remunerate them afterwards? How did a particular language model make the decision? Who coded it? Who signed off on it? This is the kind of stuff we're trying to capture. So for each step of the creation of those files, the recording of the training set, the review by human reviewers, we have an acceptance criteria with a required number of sign-offs. So what does that look like? So I want to zoom out to a large, what are we aiming for here? We're aiming for graphical or machine-readable renders, representations of decisions. So this screenshot here applies to a governance decision about a large language machine learning data model. But it would be the same if the thing being decided on is the new budget for the sales department for the next year. It's criteria for acceptance and then who signed off on it. So for each subject, this is on the left side here, the purple icon in this particular case is the governance view. You can say, okay, for each data set, this is what we're going to be looking for in terms of acceptance criteria. You can go one step farther in verifiable governance, in that you can add verifiable computation to it. So you can say, all right, these were the inputs, and here's how the inputs were gathered. Here's who signed off on them. Here's who reviewed them for accuracy and intellectual property restriction and so on. But then you can also apply computations to those inputs. And then you can lock down those computations too. You can say, this is the algorithm that was applied. Here are the machines that it was applied on. Here's who signed off on reviewing the algorithm. All right, so I see we have a couple of questions on the queue. So let's go to the queue.
Cool. Wendy.
Thanks so much. This is really an interesting exploration. And stop me if you're going to get to these questions later. But I was curious about the sort of granularity of decision recording and what assumptions that's making about the governance process. In other words, could a group decide, no, we don't want to record all of the line by line. The only thing that gets recorded is top level, yes or no. And another point about, is there a way to record sort of interlocking decisions or contingent decisions? Call it horse trading, call it compromise.
where right, somebody right, makes sense.
Is willing to support one thing only if another pull request someplace else goes through, take the package or leave it.
Absolutely. Makes sense. Yeah, both excellent questions. Yes. So the overall answer is yes, all of those can be captured. We're trying to make this as flexible as possible. A good analogy is verifiable credentials, right? The VC spec just talks about the securing outer envelope. The actual attributes that you put in there solely depend on your use case and your particular organization, right? So you can stuff a whole education history in a single verifiable credential. You can outline the steps that you took in a particular class at school, anything, right? So we're aiming for a general purpose outer securing envelope. And then inside it, that's where you would capture dependencies, whether it's software or procedural. That's where you would say which parts of the decisions are recorded and just record the outcome. So all of those things, yes, inside the envelope, right? That's kind of the only way to approach this. So again, in terms of screens, where is this going? Why? What do we want to see? We want to see our old friend, the green check mark. But what does the check mark mean? It means that at each step of the way, both from collecting the inputs, the computations, and then the reviews of the computations, each one of these was recorded when appropriate, like Wendy said, and a verifiable credential was issued about that fact, that the computation took place, the review took place, and who is that reviewed. So in this picture here, the important thing is not just the boxes that are green, because we all know how to verify a verifiable credential, but that each green line, that each green arrow, each green link is itself modeled by verifiable credential. So each box is a VC, but each line between the boxes, each relationship is a VC as well. So here, for example, the in this particular view of the data, there's multiple views, the colors represent, do we know who the issuer was? So green is, yeah, it's from a known issuer list, or it passed some other acceptance criteria. Red is, no, this is from a known recorded bad actor. And then gray is the usual majority of situations where it's the first time we're encountering, the actor is not yet known to us, and you need to apply some sort of KYC or other criteria to it. Okay, so we've got this overall idea. We're recording logs of decisions. We've provided a general purpose wrapper envelope for recording a decision, which is subject, what it's about, review request, a set of acceptance criteria and review criteria, and then the result, the overall outcome of the decision. Let's zoom in on the actors, right? Because for every decision, it's who proposed it, who reviewed, who voted. How do we represent that given the primitives that we all know and love? Well, let's take groups, for example. What do we need to model a group? Well, it would be great to have an identifier for the group. It would be good to have the group control some cryptographic keys, because you can sign, authenticate, encrypt with them, do all sorts of things. For some groups, it's important to keep a list of members, right? Some groups have secret membership, where each member doesn't know who else is in the group, and some groups are very public, and some groups members only know who the list of members are. But anyways, list of members, any kind of metadata about the group, right, where we're trying to capture group generically for all the million different incarnations that is out there in human history. And then optionally, what we can do is say, for decisions that this group takes, including who gets to be new members and then so on, or how to kick out members, this is our signing policy. This is our decision threshold. Now, are all the complex human decisions and governance items, will they be able to be expressed in a simple threshold or any sort of cryptographic signing policy? No. we're just saying that a small subset might be expressed by these simple policies. And when you come across those use cases, here's one way to represent them. So what do we have for prior? Because everybody likes prior art in specifications, and if not, they should. So what do we have for prior art for groups? We have, of course, the venerable V card, supported by Gmail, Outlook, all the emailing software out there, all mobile phones and operating systems. Oddly enough, modeling a group in vCard is extremely awkward and not well supported. Even by software that does recognize vCards in general. So for whatever historical reason, and some of you on this call have probably were in that group and know what the reason is and why it turned out that way, but vCard doesn't capture groups that well, or at least the support for the group notation is not there. We, of course, have Active Directory, which, you know, directory, basically a list of members, and then applying either distribution, which is a fancy way of saying a mailing list, or security, like permissions based on that list. And, of course, pretty much any cloud computing platform, like AWS, Google Compute, anything you care, has this notion of user groups and then permissions based on them. Okay, let's come back to the primitives that we know. We've got these DIDs. They're stable identifiers. Keys are involved. What does a DID for a group look like? And how do we list the members? Well, there's only a couple of options, right? Just abstractly speaking. We can literally add a new members property to each DID method. I mean, if we wanted to, we could wait until the next iteration of the DID working group, the DID 2.0 data model, and we can campaign for adding a members field to the general DID data model. Or we can go to each particular DID method and open pull requests and be like, hey, would you like to add a members group, a members field, so that in some cases where the list of members is public, or at least the list of their keys is public, we can put it right in the DID. As you probably imagine, that those are awkward approaches. Can't really affect the DID spec. We don't want to go to the, you know, 300 plus DID methods and convince them to add. But we do already have lists of keys in the DID data model. We have lists of keys for authentication, lists of keys for signing verifiable credentials. That's assertion method. We have lists of keys for encryption, etc. Could we use those, that existing primitive, that list of keys, to express these are the signing members of this group or organization? These are the voting members. And Bob, I see a question on, on the chat of what counts as good group support. I can come back to that if there's time at the end of the at the end of the call. That part or that claim is my own personal opinion. It's not that important. But back to DIDs. So we've got a group. How can we express either a voting policy or signature policy in a DID? How can we express a list of members? We can add a property, use an existing property, and that's what we're going to be doing in this proposal. In addition, you can have an external list of members and link out to it. And as we know, the one thing all DIDs have in common is their bags of keys and their lists of service endpoints, which are external links to pretty much anything. So we could use the service endpoint mechanism in a given DID to link to a resource, a verifiable credential that lists the group members, either in public for public groups or content behind authorization and encryption. So what does this look like using existing primitives? Here's an example DID web for a group. And in the assertion method, the signing keys, it has a key for the group itself, included, and in the DID data model, you can express keys by value, by saying this is literally the value of the public key, or by reference. You can link to externally hosted keys. So I can say, here's the key for the group, and here's a key for each of the two members. Here's Alice and Bob's keys. Meaning. So what just, even aside from this slide deck, even aside from our new spec proposals, this part is contained in the existing DID and VC data model. When you encounter this, what does this mean? What's the semantics here? Well, it's a DID with three keys, and any statement, any verifiable credential, any one of these keys signs can be attributed to the DID itself. So the base verifiable credential and DID data model tells us at very least how to model a one of X signing threshold method. And those of you are probably wondering, okay, so just looking at this, how do I tell that this is a group, that I'm looking at a group, aside from the fact that it's multiple keys? Because this could just be a person with, you know, multiple devices or just multiple keys that they're keeping around. So during the DID working group 1.0, there was an extensive discussion on, well, can we add a type field to a DID? Can we at least mark whether this DID belongs to an individual or a group? With or without members, even just being able to say, this is for a group, members are private, would require something like a type. So at the time, the group decided, no types. So what can we do now? Well, we can add a type field, which again, is either changing the base DID spec or changing each of the DID methods. You could actually, for those that use contexts, use a context to denote that this is a group type. Or you could not have types in a DID, like we currently do, and know that a particular DID is a group or an individual out of band. Meaning, how did it get on your contact list in the first place, right? Who did you get it from, etc. So that's out of scope. But it is just highlighting that encountering a raw DID, it's not obvious what's a group or what it's not. And then here's an example of linking to an external credential using a service point. Right? Again, we have a general purpose DID, we have the keys that a group controls, and then here, this particular group, because its list of members is public, can publish an external membership, VC, and link to it using service endpoint. Okay, so what have we got? We've talked about verifiable governance, log of decisions. We talked about a data model for those decisions. Most often, groups are involved, hence the governance. We're going to identify groups as DIDs. For signing purposes, we're going to use the existing DID primitive, the list of keys, as members. Optionally, we can have either a link from the DID document itself to a list of members, or we can rely completely on out-of-band mechanisms, meaning this is a DID for the Medford, Massachusetts post office. Who's the list of members? Who's the list of employees? That's out-of-band. Go call them up and find out if it's legal. Okay, so the remaining thing we want to talk about is, so how does somebody actually sign on behalf of a group? We want to be able to sign as the organization itself. Outwardly speaking, the United Nations have signed off on this proposal. We want to capture each particular individual and role involved in the signature. And we want to denote that this individual signing was not just signing as themselves, but was signing on behalf of the group, as an officer of the group, as a member. So we know how to sign credentials as individuals, right? That's the base VC data model. We have an individual DID. The DID, what does the DID do? It authorizes keys for signing, which means in a verifiable credential, that DID goes in the issuer field and the authorized key goes in the proof field. Or if you're using JWTs, goes in the detached signature, but it's the same deal. Key was authorized for that purpose by the JWK key set, and here it is in the proof. So, same thing with an organization. Notice that it's absolutely the same. When the organization signs some decision, like as itself, we can use the existing mechanism. DID, authorized keys, the organization signs something by its own keys. What do we mean by that? Who in the actual organization or group or whatever, who's going to be holding the actual signing keys? Essentially, you're going to be looking at an API. Yes, of course, you can do it manually. You can hand over to the secretary, like literally here's the printed out private key on paper, and here's where you type it in to sign it with. You could do that. But realistically, you're going to be looking at key management systems and APIs. So some secure service, preferably with hardware support, is going to be storing and not giving up its private key. And then you're going to be writing custom logic that depends on your governance to be able to say when these conditions are fulfilled, go ahead and sign as the group. And all that we're doing in this proposal is providing a notation for the subset, a simple notation for a subset of that custom logic. So this just a simple conceptual model, right? We've got organization, which in itself could or could not contain groups and roles and individuals. Skip over that. Here's what everybody wants to see. How do I, as a member of the student council, sign a resolution? We've got a couple of options. If I have a DID, I can sign a resolution as myself. And you can ask, well, how do you know that you belong to the student council? We add an out-of-band verifiable credential that says this DID belongs to the group, that's the red issuer, and optionally, your role is president. And that's, as Bob points out in the queue, instead of signing as the organization, you're signing authorized to sign for the organization. And that's exactly what we're trying to capture on these slides. How are you authorized by? You're authorized by this VC. And how is the key authorized? It's authorized by being in the assertion method list in a DID document. So here's an example with a role. Here's an example of just a group. Again, I'm a student council member. I signed it. There's an out-of-band credential showing that I belong to the group. And then lastly, we can just put the keys, like we did in a previous example that I can scroll back to if we have time at the end. We have a DID for the group. We put Alice and Bob's keys in the assertion method. And now, whenever Alice and Bob signs a verifiable credential, you can put the group's DID in the issuer. Okay, so I see we're coming up to time and we probably have lots of questions. Again, some governance decisions and cryptographic decisions can be modeled as either threshold, N of M, or just multiple signatures. For example, when the C-suite signs off on our budget, we need every single member of the C-suite to individually sign on it in whatever order, right? That's a valid governance structure. We, of course, have things called ring signatures where the votes are anonymous, though that particular tech is still kind of bleeding edge. And then we have the ability to compose all these threshold signature requirements using Boolean logic, using the verifiable conditions, which is a spec that is a work item of this very CCG. And what do we mean by verifiable condition? It basically means putting the logic, instead of a key in the assertion method of a did, you're putting Boolean logic. So for example, you're saying verifier, whenever you come across either Bob's did or Alice's, then that accepts, I find it acceptable as the issuer. And then the verifier loads the issuer did, looks and parses through the verifiable conditions, and if they match, the signature verifies. So encourage everyone to look at the verifiable condition spec. It's linked to here in the slide deck, which is in chat and will be mailed out. It's a sometimes useful mechanism. Okay, so next steps and questions. We would like to offer this spec, or at least a write-up on how to use DIDs for groups with membership. We'd like to offer it as a work item to the CCG, which will involve mailing the list, et cetera, et cetera. We want to propose a sample data model for how to denote a membership to a group or assignment to a role. And again, to capture the sheer richness of human experience, a lot can go into that data model. So we want to start with a skeleton. And we're interested in continuing work on the verifiable credentials spec that can say, in order for this VC to be valid, either the president or the three vice presidents, either or, all have to sign. Okay, questions. See, we've got Phil in the queue. Go ahead, Phil.
Yeah, really thoughtful, Dimitri, and thought-provoking. It just strikes me that you're, in some sense, providing an approach to an infrastructure around the emergence of registries of a variety of types in order to provide both a framework for governance but also a way of referencing them for
yes.
different purposes like issuer registries, et cetera. So I'd appreciate your comment on that.
Yes, absolutely. You're correct. This structure, this data model, is useful for registries and for the governance of how to add new items to known issuer registries. This is also relevant in the field of supply chain management for either software supply chain, hardware, and so on. The supply chain specs being incubated in the IATF right now have this notion of registries, and in order to get a receipt from the registry, you have to pass a number of criteria that the group will specify. And that's exactly the kind of thing this aims to capture. And notarization, right. Bob, go ahead.
Yeah, one thing is the comment I made is I think it's really important when talking about this stuff to not say things like, sign as someone else. I think signatures, we shouldn't be trying to figure out how to allow people to masquerade. We maybe, and I think we need to think more about, many of these conversations, we need to think more about rights and authorizations than just assuming that identity is the answer to everything here.
And you're absolutely correct. In fact, in earlier versions of the deck that I cut for time, I had that exact slide saying that we could just do the thing where, in a small company, the boss gives their login to the secretary and the secretary can email as them, right? That's the sort of degenerate form of delegation.
That's just wrong.
That's just wrong, but really is realistic delegation when delegation is not supported by the software. Whereas
right.
here, we're actively encouraging both delegation and specifying how long somebody is delegated for. That's the valid from and valid to in the verifiable credential, and what role they're delegated as. So 100% what you said, yes.
Okay, great. And the other thing, I am curious, and my apologies for trying to be vocabulary cop on that.
But no, this is important.
It's such a small sort of change in the way one phrases the sentence, but I think it has a tremendous impact on the way it's understood by people. The other thing is, I wonder if you could say more about sort of what what is necessary to have quote unquote good group support? Why isn't being a member of the group simply an attribute, a claim or something which is asserted by such a member? Why do we need more than that?
V-card,
for instance, you could stick an attribute in a V-card.
You can. I was saying is that the actual contact management UI implemented both iOS and Android, try and find the group functionality. It's really hard to find. Like, it's behind a bunch of UI nonsense. That's what I mean by it's not well implemented.
Okay, but that's interface. But the data structures itself, do you think groups need something more than simply the ability to associate an attribute with an individual or entity?
No. I do think that all of this data structure can be expressed in vCard as well, especially if you designate some fields to store keys in a vCard. In fact, one of my previous hats was a startup doing context management. And that's exactly what we were doing. We were putting DIDs and keys in V cards, literally, on mobile phones.
Okay, cool.
Anybody else?
By the way, I'm just curious, Dimitri, is that earlier you mentioned that the type in the DID didn't make it, but it sounds like a good idea. Do you actually know the context of why the type didn't make it?
Yes, the context was, because even the fact that this DID belongs to an individual and as a group is private information, is PII. So out of caution, that bit was dropped.
Ah, got it. Thank you.
Yeah. And Taltad points in the chat. Individual claiming membership must be claimed as a member of the group. Yes, that's what the out-of-band VCs provide. They're issued by the group saying Dimitri is a member or Bob is a member. So absolutely to what you said. All right. Thank you so much. If you're interested in this topic, we'll be proposing it as work items to the list. So talk to you on then. Feel free to reach out to myself or Ben Lau of Equity, who was not able to make most of this call, but created this with me. Here are the slide decks in chat again, and thanks again.
Thank you, Dimitri. This is an amazing presentation. I'll share this deck to the mailing list, if you don't mind.
No, please go ahead.
All right. Cool. Thanks. All right, so this concludes this week's CCG meeting. Thanks a lot.